Page 42. The awe which the Hitler Youth enjoys from his parents is but the pointed political expression of a universal state of affairs. This new relationship affects even the very first years of life, during which father image and superego are supposed to arise. Psychologically, the father is represented not by another individual, but replaced by the world of things and by the crowd to which the boy is tied. The elimination of the conflict between individual and society also affects love. With the passing of the authority of the father, the danger of catastrophic conflicts with the family fades away. Yet they have kindled abandon. Today, sex seems to be the emancipated, and still oppression goes on. Social regimentation of the relations between the sexes have gone far before racial eugenics consummated this process. It was expressed by the standardized normalcy in all spheres of mass culture. Eugenics has its roots in the Enlightenment. Science objectified sex until it could be manipulated. In its human soberness, Kant's definition of marriage as a contract for the mutual possession of the sexual organs indicts inhumane sexual privileges according to the standards of natural law. This definition had, in the 19th century, made its way into the practice of men. In contemporary mass society, the sexes are leveled in that both regard their sex as a thing over which they dispose without illusion. Girls strive to come off as well as they can in the competition with other girls, and in their eyes, flirtation enhances prestige rather than future pleasure. With Kant, they take sex as a property possessing an exchange value. Wedekind once demanded freedom of prostitution because he thought that women could catch up with male society only through conscious use of their soul monopoly. The modern girl, however, wins her freedom by exploiting the patriarchal taboo which humiliates her by placing her on a pedestal. Sex loses its power over men. It is turned on and off according to the requirements of the situation. Men no longer lose themselves in it. They are neither moved nor blinded by love. Under National Socialism, extramarital intercourse is among activities encouraged by the state as socially useful forms of labor. Love is organized by the state. During good times, children are trained as future heirs. During bad times, as prospective breadwinners for their parents. Under fascism, they are produced under the auspices of the state and delivered to it as a kind of tax. If one can still speak of taxes in a society wherein one group of magnates exploits all the rest of the population. Taxes have an obvious significance under fascism. With property owners, they contribute to accelerating the process of centralization and to beating down weaker competitors. Page 43. With the masses, their money form becomes transparent and shows forth as toil in the service of power. Part of this toil is the labor of childbirth. Under National Socialism, the girl's refusal of herself to men in uniform is deemed to be as unbecoming as ready surrender formerly was. In Germany, the image of the Virgin Mary has never quite replaced the archaic cult of the woman. Under the surface of Christian civilization, memories of matriarchal conditions were never quite extinguished. These vestiges continue to assert themselves in the common antipathy of the old spinster as well as in the German Leeds devotion to the deserted mistress long before National Socialist ostracized broods and celebrated illegitimate mothers. But the aesthetic beatitude of the Christian Virgin by far surpassed the pleasure authorized by the National Socialist regime and fed with memories of the buried past. The National Socialist regime rationalizes the mythical past which it pretends to conserve, calling it by name and mobilizing it on behalf of big industry. Where the archaic heritage did not explode the Christian form and assume Teutonic features, it gave to German philosophy and music their specific tone. The mythology in National Socialism is not a mere fake, but the spotlight thrown upon the surviving mythology liquidates it altogether. National Socialism has thus accomplished in a few years what other civilizations took centuries to achieve. The sexual freedom prescribed by the population policy does not cure the anxiety of the world of sexual taboos, but expresses mere scorn of love. Love is the irreconcilable foe of the prevailing rationality. For lovers preserve and protect neither themselves nor the collectivity. They throw themselves away. That is why wrath is heaped upon them. Romeo and Juliet died in conflict with society for that which was heralded by this society. In unreasonable surrendering themselves to one another, they sustain the freedom of the individual as against the dominion of the world of things. Those who pollute the race in National Socialist Germany remain loyal to the life and death of these lovers. In the inhuman world of National Socialism, which reserves the name of hero to clever yet beguiled youth, who in conceiving, begetting, and dying are but victims of a monstrous population policy. The racial crime resurrects what once was called heroism, namely loyalty without prospect and reason. The sad tryst of those who cannot change their ways is blinded to the rationality which triumphs outside. The daybreak in which the SS men surprise the careless lights up the monstrosity that reason has become. Ingenuity, cleverness, and readiness to strike. These lovers have not kept pace with the course of society and therefore cannot hope for its clemency in the streamlined world. Page 44. Their agony in the concentration camp, which they shrewd adherence to the Third Reich deem right, and just because those punished were neither reasonable nor clever, reveals the truth behind fascism, emancipation of sex, and behind the concession existence it entails. What it encouraged as wholesome sexuality is an expression of the same fiendish rationality that harries love. What fascism does to the victims it selects as example for its unlimited power seems to defy all reason. Its tortures transcends the power to perceive or imagine. When thought attempts to comprehend the deed, it stiffens with horror and it rendered helpless. The new order contradicts reason so fundamentally that reason does not dare to doubt it. Even the consciousness of oppression fades. The more inconsumerate becomes the concentration of power and the helplessness of the individual, the more difficult for him to penetrate the human origin of his misery. The tattered veil of money has been replaced by the veil of technology. The centralization of production which technology has made necessary conceals the voluntary concord among its leaders. More than ever, crisis takes the guise of natural and inevitable phenomena and tends to destroy entire population as they ravage continents for reserve supplies. The dimension of this process are so superhuman that even the imagination, which has withstood the mutilation of mass culture, hesitates to derive this state of affairs from its social origin. Injustice has never been more blindly accepted as a visitation of superhuman fate than it is under the spell of fascism today. When everyone talks of revamping society, hope has been overshadowed by the consciousness of universal doom. Everyone feels that his work perpetuates an infernal machine from which he manages to wheedle enough time to live, time that he proceeds to lose back by attending the machine. Thus he keeps going, expert in handling every situation and in understanding none, scorning death and yet fleeing it. To men in the bourgeois era, individual life was infinitive importance because death meant absolute catastrophe. Hamlet's line, "The rest is silence," in which death is followed by oblivion, indicates the origin of the ego. Fascism shatters this fundamental principle. It strikes down that which is tottering, the individual, by teaching him to fear something worse than death. Fear reaches farther than the identity of his consciousness. The individual must abandon the ego and carry on somehow without it. Under fascism, the object of organization are being disorganized as subjects. They lose their identical character and are simultaneously Nazi and anti-Nazi, convinced and skeptical, brave and cowardly, clever and stupid. Page 45. They have renounced all consistency. This inconsistency into which the ego has been dissolved is the only attitude adequate to a reality which is not defined by so-called plans, but by concentration camps. The method of this madness consists in demonstrating to men that they are just as shattered as those in the camps, and by this means welding the racial community together. Men have been released from such camps who have taken over the jargon of their jailers, and with cold reason and mad consent, the price, as it were, of their survival, tell their story as it could not have been otherwise than it was, contending that they have not been treated so badly after all. Those who have not yet been jailed behave as if they have already been tortured. They profess everything. The murderers, on the other hand, have adopted the language of the Berlin nightclub and garment center. The sphere of trade and business remains a reality only in the struggles and transactions among captains of industry, and it is there removed from the eye of the little man, nay, even of the big man. But the language of market mentality, Jewish slang, the vernacular of salesmen and traders who have long been humiliated, survive on the lips of their suppressors. It is the language of wings, sly hints, complicity in deceit. The Nazi call failure, pleite. He who does not watch his step in time is Meshuke, and an anti-Semitic song says that the Americans have no idea was sich tut. The instigators justify their program by saying that once again all was not quite kosher with the Jews. Getting through by hook or crook is the secret ideal, and even the SA troopers envy the Jewish brains which they cudgel. They imagine that the Jewish shrewdness they strive to imitate reflects the truth which they have to deny to themselves and to destroy. If this truth has once and for all been discarded, and men have decided for integral adjustment, if reason has been purged of all morality regardless of cost, and has triumphed over all else, no one may remain outside and look on. The existence of one solitary, unreasonable man elucidates the shame of the entire nation. His existence testifies to the relativity of the system of radical self-preservation that has been posited as absolute. If all superstition has been abolished to such a degree that only superstition remains, no stubborn man may wander around and seek happiness anywhere except in unrelenting progress. The hatred of Jews, like the lust to murder the insane, is stimulated by their unintelligible faith in a God who has everywhere deserted them, and by the unconditional rigidity of the principle they maintain, even unwittingly. Suspicion of madness is the unperishable source of persecution. It originates from distrust of one's own pragmatic reason. Page 46. Pain is the means of calling men back from the monumental world into which all empiricist philosophers and even Kant forbade them to penetrate. It was always the best teacher to bring men to reason. Pain leads the resistant and wayward, the fantast and utopian back to themselves. It reduces them to the body, to part of the body. Pain levels and equalizes everything, man and man, man and animal. It absorbs the entire life of the being whom it wrecks, reducing him to the husk of pain. Mutilation of the ego, with which the whole of mankind has been afflicted, thus again repeats itself in each case of torture.